Okay, this is Baptist Basics University. The course is the Gospel of John. The lesson is lesson number 6. We're going to talk about Jesus cleansing the temple today. We'll be looking at John chapter 2, 13 through the end of the chapter, verse 25. We'll just glance at the last few verses, probably spend a little bit more time on those in the next lesson. But and we'll deal with that a little bit there. But we're going to deal with a very unusual incident in the life of Christ. One that really breaks a lot of misconceptions about who Christ was, about just who he was as a man. A lot of times Christ is pictured as a very weak person physically, a very meek, quiet, caring, loving person, a very effeminate. And I don't think you can really get that picture from the Bible. Now, he's been painted that way by countless painters throughout the centuries. But that's not an accurate picture of who Christ was. Christ was a man. Christ was a, for 30 years of his life, he was a carpenter. And that was very hard work. I mean, odds are he was out cutting his own wood. That he was out, then, you know, once you got that wood, then you have to cut it into boards and smooth those boards out, plane them out. And, I mean, there wasn't electric tools back then. It was all by hand. If he had to drill a hole, he was drilling with a handheld auger, and very hard work that required there. So, I mean, Jesus was a hardworking individual. Strong men were attracted to him, such as fishermen, Peter and Andrew. These men were hardworking men. They were attracted to Christ. Christ was a man. I think he was a man's man. I think he was physically, I mean, a strong man. Think about even he carried this cross for a long distance after being beaten to a bloody pulp. That, I mean, a weak man could not have done such a thing, but Christ did it. And this story we're going to deal with really shatters a lot of the misconceptions about Christ's personality, about Christ's demeanor and such. It's a very strange story because, as I say, it doesn't seem to fit a lot of the modern pictures that you see, and even some of our own conceptions of Christ. Why would Christ do this? Why would Christ cleanse the temple? Why would he make a whip and do this? What's going on here? So we're going to deal a lot with the setting of this, and I hope that I'm not boring people by doing this, but I think that it's important to know what's going on, and I don't want to just go verse by verse and explain it as we get to it. I want to lay the background for all this stuff so as we're going through it, you can help you to understand. And so that's what we're going to do here. Let's look a little bit about the setting here. This story takes place about a year into the Christ ministry. You have to remember that the book of John, most of it deals with the last about week or so of Christ's life. So the 3.5 or so years of Christ's ministry just fly by. So even though we're just at the end of chapter 2 here, this takes place about a year into Christ's ministry. So we start out, John's given a lot of details about the very beginning, but now the first miracle, the first disciples, the baptism, stuff that happens immediately when he began his ministry, but now we're dealing about a year into it or so is what most of the commentaries I've read say. The occasion of this is the Passover feast, one of the major feasts in the Jewish religion. This is one of those that there's three major feasts that the men were supposed to go to Jerusalem. And those were the Feast of Passover, which took place on the 15th day of the month, Nisan. Always liked that. I used to have a Nissan Altima I drove, so I always kid around, with that. But Nissan, something like that. I'm not sure the exact pronunciation on that. And even if I did with my Texas tongue, it probably wouldn't come out right. But this equivalates to about March or April for us when you transfer from the Jewish calendar to our the Julian calendar that we're under now. It's not the Julian, whatever the name of the calendar is we're under now. I can't remember. I've gone blank. It's a very interesting study to get into. The Jewish calendar is based on the lunar calendar, and so it does not match up exactly with our calendar at all. Ours is 365 days, and theirs is, I think, 360, something like that. In fact, instead of having leap days, having a leap year and having one extra day in February, they actually will have a leap month to correct their calendar and stuff with it. It's amazing. But theirs is based on lunar. Ours is based on the solar. And ours is more accurate time, but unfortunately, the Jewish calendar is the one that the prophecies and stuff will deal with. When you get into Revelation, it goes to a lunar calendar, and a lot of people think that something happens, maybe an asteroid hitting the Earth or something, and sets it back to a 360-day calendar. Interesting stuff. I don't want to get into all that conspiracy theory. That's not where we're going, but it's very interesting stuff if you want to study out the calendars and such. So anyway, that the Feast of Passover was the first one, 15th day of Nisan. The next one would be the Feast of Pentecost. It takes place 50 days after Passover. That's where Pentecost comes from. Pente is 50, and that's it's 50 days after Passover. Pentecost is the like a Greek name for it, but that's what 50 days after Nisan, or 15 days from the 15th of Nisan. And I don't have the exact date on that, but it's just 50 days later. And then the third one is the Feast of Tabernacles, which takes place on the 15th of Tishrei. That equivalents to September, October for us in the fall. So those are the three major feasts that the people are supposed to attend, that the men are supposed to go up. On these days, Jerusalem would like quadruple in size. If you want to read about that, you can read some about that in some of like Alfred Edersheim's books. Sketches of Jewish Social Life talks a little bit about that. How hospitable Jews were during these times, and how, I mean, you know, everybody was putting family in their houses, and basically there for just a few days every time of year, Jerusalem would swell up to be one of the largest cities in the world, where though it was an important city, it really, there was much larger cities out there, but during this one, or during these times during the year, it would swell up and be one of the largest, if not the largest, in the world. Very interesting. So we got the Passover feast here. Now, of course, the Passover goes back to, it's that commemoration of the Passover in Egypt, where they took the lamb and put its blood on the doorpost, and the death angel came and killed all the firstborn in the homes of those who did not slay the lamb. And that's where it goes back to, and God commanded them to commemorate that and have an observance of that. So what they would do, they would still have a lamb and take a lamb, and they'd keep it a few days, a spotless lamb, just like they did back in the original Passover. They would then roast the lamb and eat it. They would eat it with bitter herbs and unleavened bread. Unleavened bread was supposed to kind of symbolize not just getting the sin out, because leaven speaks of sin, but even just because they were in such a hurry leaving that they didn't have time for the bread to rise. So that's why they ate the unleavened bread. And the bitter herbs, it's just to further make it a solemn occasion. It wasn't a celebratory feast. It was a very solemn occasion. And another thing they would do is actually put all the leaven out of the house. This is something that modern Jews still do when they celebrate this. They kind of have a little ceremony, and they'll hide a little, like a little bag of leaven in the house, and one of the kids will find it, and they ceremoniously like throw it out the door. Kind of an interesting deal how that's still even practiced there. In fact, they still eat unleavened bread and the bitter herbs and stuff too. And I'm not an expert on that. I should have studied that a little bit more. But even back then, this is what's going on here. It's the Passover feast. And all this is about to go on here. Because it's saying in verse 13, it says, "And Jews' Passover was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem." So it's just before the Passover, but there's already people there. And there's going to be these crowds coming to observe this feast. And this episode is going to take place at the temple. Now, this temple is Herod's temple. That's most people consider it the third temple. First temple was Solomon's temple, of course, which was destroyed by the, well, I'm going blank, it's the Babylonians that destroyed it. And then the second temple was built, and you can read about Ezra, that was called, oh my goodness, I've gone blank. But anyway, but the second temple was built, and it was not nearly as pretty as Solomon's temple, more of a crude structure. And anyway, when Herod became king over the regions there, one of the things he did to partly to pacify the Jews and partly to improve their own standing to make them look bigger, he went about on a big building, rebuilding deal of the temple and the area surrounding it and such. In fact, it went on for, I think, almost 70 years. But it's really a rebuilding, a remodeling of the second temple. But most people, because it was so expansive, most people consider it to be a third temple, just a totally separate one. I mean, it's just amazing when we read about that. But it's Herod was motivated. Herod was kind of nominally a Jew. He really, I think, was more a follower of the Greek stuff. But he, at least in some cases, would put up a facade of being a Jew. But he was also very conscious of his standing and you know, keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak. So, you know, and a lot of his building projects were not just to make himself look good, but it was also to put his kingdom, try to put it on the equal with some of the other more developed kingdoms and some of their stuff. So that's why, you know, they didn't have a sea harbor, so he worked to build Caesarea where and basically make a man-made harbor there, kind of a really neat deal. I mean, building places like Masada and some of that, some in his palaces and such. I mean, these were major building projects. And probably the pinnacle of all his stuff was the work he did at the temple. And as they, it wasn't just the temple itself. They basically redo all the courtyards. They redo all the walls. They redo even like, you know, all the entrances and the steps and everything. It was this, this was a major, major reconstruction of the entire Mount Moriah complex there. Pretty neat deal. And the shame of it is, in a way, is that this was only finished just a short time before it was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD. I've read some people say that it was a few months or so or a few years, but I mean, it really had not been finished very long. I say it had been building almost 70 years, if I remember right. Now, in the temple, we're going to talk about this. Key to the story are the money changers and the merchants that Christ has an issue with here. And this did not take place in the, like, the temple courtyard itself, you know, where the altars were and all that, but kind of in the outer courts and such. There was this thriving business going on, and what they would do, okay, let's talk about the money changers a little bit. Every Jew was supposed to give a half shekel of silver as a kind of a temple tax to help support the temple, and this goes all the way back to the Mosaic Law. And what the Jewish authorities decided was that, you know, different coins had different silver quality and content and such. So they basically approved a certain coinage to be accepted because it was pure and it was the right weight. And what they ended up approving and using was the Tyrian shekel. It was minted in Tyre. Pretty neat coin. You want to read about that. It was one of the standards. I mean, just really in that region, it was kind of the standard for silver. So pretty neat deal. I have a little half shekel, supposedly, that I've purchased. It's pretty neat little coin. The interesting thing about it is the head on it is the Tyrian deity Melkarth. And so there's a pagan god on it. And the other side, there's an eagle, which is not a good thing in Jewish typology either. And so you got this pagan money that's being used. But because it was the right weight and the right purity, they approved it. It was easily found. So there's a lot of reason for it. So the Jewish authorities said, well, we'll overlook the fact that it has a false god on it, and we'll still use it. So what they would do is when you went to the temple to pay your temple tax or anything else that would require, you know, that type of thing, you would go to a money changer, and it was kind of like a money exchange deal, and they would take your money and exchange it for this, you know, approved currency. And of course, there was a fee involved, which worked out. It wasn't a straight percentage, but it works out to be about 11, 12%, somewhere like that. And you can study that out. I wish I didn't. I've got a coin book that talks about them finding the ruins of a house in Jerusalem. And what they would often do for good luck is put a coin or something in the wall of a house during the construction. And they found this house, and it had a whole bunch of it had a little jar in the wall, and it was full of the little Jewish Purda coins, little bronze coins. And it was an odd number, very strange odd number. They couldn't figure out why, and they finally figured out, well, what this guy was doing was putting enough for a half shekel of silver, or a half shekel or full shekel, I don't remember, inside that jar, because he didn't put the real coin in there, but he put enough money to exchange for one, and he even added the coins for the fee in there. It's pretty interesting. So, but that's what you do. You would go in and exchange your prudas or Roman coins to get this approved money, the Tyrian shekel or half shekel, to pay your dues there at the temple. And there was a couple other offering kind of things that applied to also. And it wasn't that these coins were not circulated, but they were not very circulated. Most of these coins rarely left the temple compound. They just kind of circulated back out. People would, I think the priests would actually convert them back into, you know, regular money and then use that for different things. It's those type of coins that Judas would have been paid with. 30 pieces of silver were 30 shekels of silver that he was paid for delivering Christ. Would have been those coins too. Interesting thing. I like the coins. So, since people traveled so far to bring sacrifices to heart, I mean, can you imagine traveling 100 miles to Jerusalem to offer, you know, a lamb or a bullock or something like that? Well, you've got to travel all that way. It's hard on you. It's hard on the poor little lamb or whatever. And, you know, if something happened, say you're halfway there and your lamb falls off the ledge of the road and breaks its leg, well, then you can't offer it for a sacrifice. So, some great entrepreneurs of the time decided, hey, let's sell animals at the temple. So they also would raise the animals and bring them up there. And if you need to offer a dove or a bullock or a lamb, they had them. And all you had to do was just come up and buy one. So some great Christian entrepreneurship there, I guess you could say. Boy, I don't even want to get into that. A lot of these people that sell Christian merchandise, what's this? I think they rip off people more than anything. They stick Jesus' name on something and expect Christians to pay more than a fair market price for it. But anyway, that's just one of my little pet peeves, kind of just like they used to do back then. So anyway, this is what was going on. There's a thriving business. So basically, parts of the temple were a marketplace. I mean, it was, you were going to Walmart almost. So that's what was going on with that. So with that, let's jump right into our story here, and we'll see in, let's flip back over here, chapter 2, and we'll see beginning chapter 2, verse 13, the Jewish Passover was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem, easily could be millions of people are there at this time, hundreds of thousands is a safe estimate. It says, he found in the temple those that sold oxen, sheep, and doves, and the changers of money. That's what he found. He goes there and sees these people and their business, and they said they were hot. It was a boisterous business. Can you imagine having all those animals and people would be shouting out their prices and just kind of like a street fair deal? I mean, it was a market inside the temple compound. And verse 15 says, and when he made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money, and overthrew the tables. So we have Christ doing something a little bit out of character, according to some people. This man of love and mercy got a little upset and pulled some of his authority as the Son of God, as the one that's being worshipped in the temple, and even makes a whip, takes a weapon in his hand, and drives these people out of the temple. I'd like to see some of those Renaissance painters paint that. That'd be a little bit hard with their little effeminate Jesus pictures. And Verse 16, it says, and said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. Well, I'm having trouble with the S's today. And so the motivation for this, purify the worship at the temple. Christ is purifying his house. It's supposed to be a house of prayer, a house of worship, and these people have made it a den of thieves. That's a verse I believe is in another. It's in another one of the passages that deal with this. So his motivation is purify the worship there. And remember, Jesus. That's why Jesus came, was to correct our relationship with God, and to open the door for us. And in doing that, there was things in the way of people worshiping God under the system in place at the time, and Jesus, you know, uses his authority and cleans it up. It's amazing. This is a sign of authority. Most of the rabbis and stuff, the leaders at the time, rarely spoke with authority. You'll see that often about Christ. They'll talk about, this man spoke with authority. When a rabbi taught, all he would do is sit up there and quote other dead rabbis and what they thought, and kind of give maybe his humble opinion in the matter after he had quoted everybody else. And if you read some of that rabbinical writing, it is boring stuff. So, I mean, when somebody came in and spoke with authority, it got people's attention. And this got people's attention. There's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people at Jerusalem during this time. And this man in the central place in Jerusalem, in the temple, where everybody's starting to mill around for the coming Passover, where people are probably coming, they don't get to come very often, they're going up there and to take part and to witness some of the temple ceremonies that they did every day. And this man from Galilee just came in there and drove out all the money changers, these people that people had used for years now. The money changers and the merchants. He had just drove them all out. This would create no small stir. This would get people's attention. And in verse 17, it talks about the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. That is a quote of Psalm 69, verse 9. I'll tell you a funny story about that. In David McCull's book, Mornings on Horseback, about the Teddy Roosevelt's childhood. Didn't finish it. Kind of got a little boring. Some of David McCull's books are very good. John Adams is very good, and some of the others. Very good writer, very good historian. But in that book, it tells a story about a young Teddy Roosevelt being scared to go to church. And they asked, and they couldn't figure out why he didn't want to go to church. He'd never done that before, but he was scared to go to church. And finally, his mother or somebody sat down with him and asked him what the matter was, and he said he was scared. And they said, well, why is he scared? And he told him the preacher he preached about, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. And they thought about it, and just a few weeks prior, they had been down on the docks, and somebody had a dead seal, and they had never seen one. And so he had seen that seal and seen its teeth and stuff, and so he thought a seal was that zeal of the Lord that's going to eat him up. So he's scared to go to church, thinking he's going to get eaten up by that seal he saw. So kind of a funny story, and you can probably tell that a lot better than I can, but I like that. I've always wanted to use it. I think it's the first time I've got to use it. I've told that to a few people, but I think it's the first time I ever got to use it in a lesson. So anyway, verse 18, then entered the Jews and said unto him, what sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? The Jews always seeking for a sign. Hey, what's this mean? Is this a sign? Are you trying to tell us something? What's going on here? Verse 19, Jesus answered and said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. So Jesus says, okay, you want a sign? I'll give you the sign I'm going to give to you. You destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up again. He's talking about his own body there. This is consistently what he says. Matthew 12:39. You can cross-reference this. Consistently, the sign is, you're going to destroy this temple, my body, in 3 days I'll be in the grave, the sign of Jonas, and I will raise it up again. He's constantly saying, the sign I'm going to give to you, why I'm the Messiah, is that I will die, I will spend 3 days in the grave, and I will rise up again. So he prophesies his own resurrection right here. Some people say, oh, Jesus never spoke about that. You know, there's very little he spoke about. He didn't know he was going to die. No, he knew he was going to die. Right there, he's trying to tell them, hey, I'm going to die. Verse 20, then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? So at this time, this 46 years, they've already been working on the temple structures there. It's been a long time. They're like, well, how in the world are you going to build it back in 6 days? They didn't get the typology that he was using. And at verse 21, but he spake of the temple's body. They didn't get what he was saying. A lot of times Jesus would do that, and like in the parables, he wouldn't come out and say what it was, but he would speak in a parable, in a story, or in a symbol. In fact, a lot of times in the Bible, it's written that way. And that's what he did here. Verse 22. And when therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said unto them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. So this is something even his own disciples didn't understand, didn't get, until after Jesus had risen up from the dead. You know, the easiest way to catch prophecy in the Bible is after it's already passed. You know, it's easy to look back now in the Old Testament and see all the verses that talk about Christ coming, about his birth, about his ministry. But at that time, it was very hard. It's easy because we know what happened. It's easy for us to see fulfilled prophecy because we see the fulfillment. And that's kind of a danger to get into with the folks that want to major on the end times. Because, you know, we don't know exactly what's going to happen during the tribulation. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with, you know, Armageddon or the rapture. Now, we know some of the stuff, but you really cannot piece together prophecy exactly until its fulfillment is already passed. Now, we can still learn from that. And it's a very good science. And there's a lot of people that do it very well. But there's some people that take it too far. And, I mean, they'll tell you what color shoes the Antichrist is going to wear. Crazy stuff like that. That's taken a little far. But you got to think, even his disciples did not get what Jesus said. He's on prophesying his own death right here. They didn't get it till after it was fulfilled. So might be something to keep in mind next time you won't go off on a tangent into some prophecy and something like that. And well, let's wrap this up real quick. We'll look at these last three verses, and we'll deal with those a little bit. Just kind of the further results, we'll see what happened. Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover and the feast day, many believed in his name, and when they saw the miracles which he did, but Jesus did not commit himself unto them, because he knew all men, and needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. So all these crowds of people there, they've heard about what Jesus did. Jesus just expressed his authority in cleansing the temple. They've heard about it. Word is spread, and people are beginning to flock, believe on him. He's performed some miracles, evidently, that aren't recorded. So people are beginning the tide's still rising. He's gaining popularity. People are for him. People are flocking to him. And now, that's going to continue for a while, but eventually, that's going to turn, and he's not going to be as popular as he once was. Right now, they're still hoping for that Messiah that is going to overthrow the yoke of Roman bondage. And Christ did not come to do that. He came to overthrow the burden of sin, not the burden of Roman bondage. And so, they're still looking for the wrong time of his Messiahship. And that's why it says in verse 24, talks about him not committing himself unto them, because he knew all men. If he had committed himself to the crowd, he would have. He knew that they probably would have had a riot and attempted to overthrow the Romans and set him up as king. A human leader probably would have taken this opportunity with the throngs of people, all this popularity, to ride that into power. Christ did not, because that was not his aim. Time and time again throughout history, we see this, how a dictator will ride that wave of popularity into office when just the right moment, when everything seems to be on their side, they'll do it. I mean, people like Fidel Castro did it. Even ancient history, guys like Julius Caesar and Vespasian even did it, following the year of four emperors. I mean, he came in and nobody wanted to mess with him. You know, partly because they were scared of him, but partly because he was popular. He just won a war, or was winning a war in Judea. So, So it's like, it wasn't man's timing, but God's. This was not God's time for Christ to be Messiah, or he was Messiah, but not time for him to become king. He will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords one day, but this was not the time. If Christ were to ride popular in earthly power, this was his chance. He's a rising star. People loved him. People were ready to accept him. And this would have been the time he could have done it. So that's a quick look at that, Jesus cleansing the temple. I hope that you've learned something from that. I hope you take a little something with it. It's a very, very strange and story in the life of Christ. I think this and probably the Garden of Gethsemane are probably the two stories that just people don't understand. The Mount of Transfiguration is another one also that are very hard to understand. They're just these little events in his life that have tremendous meaning to them, but they often get glossed over because they are difficult to understand. So I hope maybe that I've laid enough background to help you understand it and explain the passage a little bit for you. Now, next lesson, we're going to deal with the most famous conversation Jesus ever had, his interview with Nicodemus. It's often called an interview in the commentaries I've read, so I'll probably use that phrase quite a bit. But we'll look at that, and this is at the same time, we'll see, because really the last part of chapter 2, those last three verses are setting up chapter 3. Jesus didn't trust all men, but he did trust Nicodemus. He saw something in him that he was honestly wanting to know the truth. So we'll do a little bit about who Nicodemus was and who he was and the conversation and such there. Boy, a lot of tremendous stuff. Won't be able to get too deep into that, but I hope you'll join me for that. I thank you for listening to this one and appreciate your interest in Baptist Basic University. Thank you very much.